The weeds. I hate putting weeds.
Welcome to Radio Free School.
Hi, I'm Bronwyn, and I'm going to talk about the garden. We go on our bikes, and it's fun. We don't need to take the bus. I like to pull out weeds and potatoes and grow them, put the seeds in the soil, and dig mounds. I like everything in the garden, especially picking. And picking the weeds is the least. And I like picking leeks and everything. Right there in the garden, I get to eat mint. And I like picking up mint from our garden, like, right out back. But I like our garden that we have to ride our bikes to more because it has more food. I like to water it. But when Daddy puts on sprinklers sometimes to water the garden, I take off my shirt and I run by it to try not to get wet. But then I have to wait for my body to dry off before I can put my T-shirt on. One time I did that, and me and Daddy went for a little hike, and then we came back and put back on my T-shirt.
Nice. Yep.
Let me see your name.
Hi, I'm Mummy.
Okay.
What do I do in the garden?
Yeah.
I don't do very much because I don't really go to the garden that often.
Yeah, but what did you do last summer?
I planted a few seeds, and I did a bit of weeding, but not very much.
Do you pick? Did you pick plants?
I sometimes pick stuff out back here, back garden, just pick up something like mint, some bit of parsley sometimes, tomatoes, green beans. Not much. I get the children to do it. It's just that it's a bit of a hike to get there.
I don't think so. I think it isn't very long.
And that's the problem with that. I wanted the community garden to be very close to where I live, so I can just walk over and be there like in 3 minutes.
Next year, do you want to get a bigger garden?
Yes. Well, I want to be able to get involved in the one we've got.
How do you like it?
I love it. I think it's great.
Yeah.
Wonderful thing to have. Okay. Bye.
This year I grew, we grew things like leeks, tomatoes, potatoes, green beans, yellow beans. We also grew squash, zucchini, cucumber, that kind of stuff. You get to pick the fruit and you get to sow the seed. That's the fun part. Weeding is the boring part. The hard part. The part that no one wants to do but everybody has to do. The biggest part of the garden, weeding. We're going to fill up the whole garden and use the space more reasonably. And then maybe we'll get 2 plots a year after that and grow even more things. Like peppers. We also had lettuce, but that didn't work out. Mint grows basically everywhere that the climate's right and someone might have dropped some like a seed and you're going to grow mint. Anyway, there's a lot of mint around the garden, so especially around the hoses, the hose pipes and all that, because it was so wet around there. And well, the mint had such a great climate. If we'd grown lettuce there, it would have probably grown pretty well. Lettuce like the sunlight and cool weather. The lettuce doesn't like the weather we had. It was so hot and sunny, and they all went to seed so quickly and got all tall and not wide.
The weeds. I hate putting weeds. My favorite part about garden is picking the stuff.
What did you pick?
Squash, tomatoes, green beans, yellow beans. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I sit on roots when I'm having a break.
I really like squishing potato bugs and then the juice squirting out.
Ew!
All over my fingers, stained orange, the flesh and the blood of the potato bugs. Everybody hates potato bugs, but I like them. I met some people at the garden. Some of them offered advice on different things or gave us some extra stuff that they had grown. And that was very nice. It was very nice. There were some very beautiful people there.
You want a bigger garden next year?
Bigger.
What did you wish there was more of?
Help.
More help, Madeline. Next year you're going to help more, okay?
No! No pulling up weeds. Deal, Daddy?
No.
All I'll do in the garden is pick fruit.
No.
I'm the picker.
What about squishing the bugs?
No! I'm a harvester.
I only do my...
No, I don't get the glory without doing the dirty work.
My name's Simon, and I have been gardener here at Dundurn for 2 years now, as three phases of a landscape restoration, because it's the whole landscape. The house was here with the landscape being a picturesque landscape, and this garden, Victorian kitchen garden, would have been part of it. So we are trying to rebuild this garden that McNabb would have here with a gardener. And our focus date, the date that we are pretending that we are, is about 1855 to 1860. The garden is 1.8 acres. And it is just short of the original garden size, which would have been about 2.2 acres. So this garden, intensively grown, would have grown all the fruits and vegetables for the family. It would have also provided cut flowers and herbs and a pretty place to come and show
your
guests.
How big is the family?
The family itself at this point is four people, but there are about 10 servants. And because McNabb at this point, Sir Alan Napier, McNabb is Premier of the Combined Provinces of Canada, essentially a pre-Confederation Prime Minister, all the guests that would have been coming would have been fairly impressive. So there would have been times when you would have sat down to a table of 20 or more people. So the garden is broken up. It's got a very traditional pattern. There is a series of four square beds. There's areas for fruit trees, for small fruits and cane fruits. So we can walk down through that and get a look at it.
Do you know what these are? Do you like things that taste funny? Are you brave?
Pretty brave.
Pretty brave? You're brave. Give that a bite. You're a brave young man. They're very, very pretty, aren't they? You can eat the whole flower if you want. Wah! They got a tang to it?
No, thanks.
But these are nasturtiums. The clover here is a green crop. It holds the ground in place. Because the clover is a legume, it fixes nitrogen. So it holds the soil, adds nitrogen, and when we turn it in, it will build up the soil. It's also holding the weeds back for us, too. There's a water feature in the center here, and so the paths go out not unlike a compass, four ways from this central point, which is another really traditional feature. But this, with water in it during the day, allows the gardener to water plants with a watering can. So dipping pond is another traditional feature of Victorian kitchen garden. The wall that surrounds this, so all of those things are elements of Victorian kitchen gardens, and this garden style goes back a long, long way. The fence, almost like the little piece of Eden or paradise, is separated off and kept from the big savage hinterland, right? It's weeded and kept pristine. Okay. So there's that very sort of mythical core to it. That was a practical reason for having it. You can have the south-facing fences will take more heat in the spring and keep the crops warmer, though you can have a season extension because of the sort of microclimates that are in the garden. Rain. Is it going to rain?
I thought it'd drop a rain.
Well, gardens need rain. If you guys look in here, you can find some of these yellow tomatoes and give them a taste if you want.
Yellow?
The other thing you can taste is these.
I've seen those things before.
That's okay.
So if you are not stepping on the plants, you can make your way down through there and pick some of those.
I think they're called ground cherries.
Yeah, ground cherries. You know why they're called ground tomatoes?
No, why are they called, why?
When they're not on the ground, like when they're in the plant, they are not ripe. But when they're on the ground and the lantern is dirty brown, then it is ready. And you rip it open and inside there's a tiny yellow tomato.
This is a yellow pear tomato. This has been grown in Canada since the early 1800s, late 1700s. So this is Upper Canada plant that's being grown here again today. So that's part of the ideal too, is going back to the heirloom open pollinated varieties that we can have, that hopefully McNabb would have had in here.
We can have a garden like this.
Yeah.
In the summer we've had these things that are sort of like,
they're supposed to make wine and beer.
Well, when you squish them, they sort of smell like alcohol. They make them into beer and then store the wine.
Did you grow anything else in your garden?
Well, what we're now growing is alfalfa sprouts. And basil.
Yeah. So herbs.
We're gonna make it bigger with onions and tomatoes and all that stuff.
Any favorite vegetables that you like really a lot?
Well, I do like a few. Carrots, sprouts,
yeah,
and peas, yes, like sprouts, like broccoli sprouts.
Yeah.
They taste just like broccoli, I think. Mm. And radish sprouts, they taste spicy, just like radishes.
Yeah.
So it's like the sprouts taste almost as the same as the fruit.
How about you two? What's your favorite vegetable? What do you like?
I like broccoli.
Yeah.
And cauliflower.
Cauliflower's good, yeah.
I like carrots.
Carrots, yeah.
And broccoli.
Mm.
Getting a sense of just how much food you can grow on a piece of land like this is kind of cool. 1945, there was Victory Gardens in the United States provided 50% of the fruits and vegetables eaten. That's a stunning amount of produce to come out of essentially backyards and community plots, you know. In order to be able to turn around as a society today and do that same thing, the idea of information and understanding or hand skills being lost with a generation, you know, that's kind of... You kind of have to wonder if that's the point that we're at with some of these things. There's a real sense of loss that we are losing some, but that is becoming all so much more vital again and integral to how we understand how we fit in the environment. Yeah. What's growing? There's leeks,
yeah.
An oxheart carrot, which is another old carrot, some transplanted lettuce, which will grow in the fall a little bit. But the ones that are here are actually what's referred to as a tennis ball lettuce, which you would think wouldn't be a very old name, but Thomas Jefferson grew them. On the edge of the beds, we've got some mint. On this side, we've got some thyme. Another old tomato here, lovely old one. It's done reasonably well. Chard, and again, we had Hubbard squash in this patch here, so they've come off. If you look over here, you can see these plants are very, very similar in structure.
Yeah.
So this is cardoon, and this is artichokes, and so their plants are really cousins, but here they've been cultivated to use for the flower buds that you think of as artichokes, and here they've been cultivated to use for the stems and the stalks and the leaves. These have been drawn up and they've got burlap around them as a way of blanching them. So you blanch the core of the plant, and then they'd be harvested and used like a big coarse celery, very spicy or fairly spicy celery, and then be able to have a sauce with them. When you look at all the coal crops here, same plant essentially, but just grown and with different things focused on, whether it's this is a sprouting broccoli, so it's grown not the big heads that you get, but just kind of sprouts off, and you keep cutting them and they'll just keep coming. But cousins of the cabbages and cousins of the kale, how is a civilization we take one plant and use it in many, many different ways?
They benefit from the native knowledge already, that was good.
Well, when you think of the three sisters, corns and bean and squash, I mean, they were being grown in the Americas, they have been cultivated for thousands and thousands of years.
Yeah.
They have then gone out to Europe, and a lot of them then came right back here again. Things like the Hubbard squash went via the West Indies and then back to the States. But those plants were originally being grown here.
There were three links of chain, every link was Jesus' name. Keep your hand on that plow, hold on. Mary, Margaret, Luke, and John, all them prophets are dead and gone. Keep your hand on that plow, hold on. Oh, Lord, oh, Lord, keep your hand on that plow, hold on. Well, I've never been to heaven, but I've been told streets are fair lined with gold. Keep your hand on that plow, hold on.
Radio Free on CFMU.
This corn over here is Stowell's Evergreen Corn. The Bruce Seed Company was growing plants and selling seeds in the mid-1800s, 1850s, and I've got a copy of one of their catalogs of 1862. One of the corns that they list is Stowell's Evergreen Corn. And I was able to, through Seeds of Diversity, a Canadian seed-saving group, they had a company listed, and their seed listings included Stowell's Evergreen Corn. So I was able to put the same plant back in here. So we have some that are more generic. I've got a Moon and Stars watermelon over here, which is an old watermelon. There was about five listed in Stowell seed catalog. I haven't been able to track any of those down. With all of these things, it is a challenge to search back those original varieties, and there's a lot of guesswork because it becomes cloudier and cloudier the closer to the center you get. Saving seeds on the grander scale of things, when you talk about genetic diversity, you have to. I mean, it has turned around quite significantly. There was a real decline in available of older open-pollinated seed varieties all the way up to the 80s and into the end of the 80s, early 90s. But then there started to be a turnaround. There's more of a call, and in a lot of the sort of stands, whether it's Stokes or Ontario Seed Company or like the bigger seed dam seeds, you started to see more heritage varieties, open-pollinated varieties, being brought back or advertised as important product and not just kind of sloughed off. What part of what was also happening is there was larger seed companies and larger companies buying up smaller companies and tossing out the stuff that was more marginal. With heritage variety of seeds, you tend to get things that ripen less consistently, perhaps don't have shipping qualities, perhaps are more susceptible to disease, but there are a lot of values to some of those plants too. So when you don't have the consideration of being able to package something and ship it 1,000 miles, you can grow a different kind of vegetable. So in terms of diversity, it's nice to see those things beginning to come back. Groups like Seeds of Diversity or Seed Savers Exchange in the United States working on bringing. There's a fellow who lives just across the back here, an old Portuguese fellow, who has beans that his grandfather grew in the Azores, right? Wow. So there are still lots of local heirloom varieties available. Bring them back into the fold or bring them back into circulation, and groups of people taking on the responsibility of growing those things out, learning the needs of keeping that gene pool clean, how to grow them properly, how much separation you need between this plant and the next. Some plants are fairly easy to keep, like beans. Some of the lettuces are not too bad to keep. Some sort of tomatoes are not too bad to keep. Things like potatoes are fair because they're, you know, it's vegetative that you're just taking potatoes and regrowing potatoes. But some of the things like the cabbages are much harder to keep. Squashes are much harder to keep because they'll cross-pollinate. Corn is really difficult. You need a lot of separation between it and the next corn in order to save it. Carrots are difficult to keep because there's Queen Anne's lace, a wild carrot, which will cross-pollinate, and then you start to lose the strain. So there is a lot of knowledge to sort of practice to be used in order to maintain strains. But once you have an association in place or a group of people in place and you kind of keep that knowledge in place and build that up, or individual experience, then you can start to take on the responsibility of keeping plants over generations. And it is generations. You know, you lose some of these things for a generation and they're gone. If you go back and you consider that these things were brought into cultivation by groups of people in little small clusters, sometimes they would get passed from person group to group, and people would migrate and people would cross up and be on important or trade routes, and things would get moved around, and you can see how that would go and become commercial. But really, it's lots of small people growing really appropriate things for their microclimate, their niche, and for their needs and their uses. There would have been thousands and thousands, but it gets brought down to hundreds and hundreds. Holstein cows is an example. All of the Holstein cows in Canada last year or the year before were, through artificial insemination, were inseminated by seven sires. You know, and that's stunningly small gene pool, right? that's scary small gene pool. You know, but it becomes that monoculture. And the downside of that is, and what people are becoming more aware of, is you get one disease that particular gene pool is susceptible to, and it can do devastating harm. Whereas if you have more genetic diversity, then you have that layer of security. And so those are questions that we can ask here and bring up and sort of make more obviously relevant to kids and groups that are coming in here, and by beginning to talk about them. We are trying to grow it in as organic way as possible. I can't rely on that sort of cycle of nutrients on the property. I have to go off and bring things in. I try to compost and green manure as much as I can, but that again is something we have to build up. Well, McNabb would have had access to arsenic and copper sulfate and all kinds of things, but so this is the other side of that argument, that we're trying to not do that. Another part of that is this would have been a working farm with cows and chickens. There would have been horses as well for carriage and for riding. So manure would have been is a regular part of ashes from the fireplace, a regular part of the sort of cycle of sort of what we would think of as nutrients or materials on the garden that would come through from the house and you know, all the food being sent up and being processed back down. Well, a lot of stuff is going out to the bay. Well, perhaps thankfully, perhaps not. You can consider that part. Cold frames is a way of starting. They're retaining some heat with the brick surround and the glass because you're also keeping some of the drafts out and solar gain through the day. You're just increasing the year by 2-3 weeks at the beginning of the year. So you can get things in and get them started and get that little bit of a head start and then transplant out into the gardens. A lot of things you can direct seed, and some things you can wait till things warm up. You know, things like beans like it nice and warm, but peas and some of the like the long pod or the old English beans, they like it when it's cooler, so you can get those directly into the ground. But some things need to be coddled a little bit. Some things don't like being transplanted, but it's that trade-off. If you can get them out that little bit earlier and give them a chance, it's nice to start them in cold frames like this. Hotbeds are nice too, and they give you 2 or 3 more weeks of growing time, and in fact, you can use them even in wintertime if you've got them set up in the right aspect in the right setting. Hotbed is like a cold frame, but it's got a cavity in the bottom. So you would, instead of filling this with soil, you would fill it with manure and generate heat, would cover it with soil. And so 2 tons of manure will keep, once it starts, it gets up to temperature, will keep a hotbed like this warm for weeks and weeks. And so you can have nice warm melons and peppers and those kinds of things starting much earlier, and even in fact growing right through in some instances. But it's ideally get them planted out and then they grow once the weather catches up here. Produce gets used in 4 main ways. It gets used in interpretation in the house, in the kitchen. It gets used in the restaurant itself as seasonable produce going into the restaurant. So we have that whole slow food idea and local seasonal food being used. Support for volunteers because they work hard. So that's the kind of community gardening aspect of it, that we don't do it as individual plots, but as a whole picture, as a more of a cooperative effort, that it makes sense that volunteers also take something away at the end of the day.
Lift you up to one of the lower ones, and you can pick it with your hands.
What have you got?
Come on, let's go find the lower one. Okay, let's go find an apple tree. I think it's in good lower down. Find some apple ones in the apple tree.
What are you doing?
Apple picking.
Now, how about that tool? Do you think it's easier to use that tool?
Yeah.
Or is it easier to just climb a tree?
I think it's more fun to climb the tree.
Might be more fun, but then you won't get as many, right?
But it's more fun because you can just throw them down into a basket or something. Okay, you get this up high, and then kind of get it up onto the side, and then pull it.
Just pull it, eh?
Yeah.
Joe told me that it should just sort of fall in, like you just put it up and then give it a little twist, and it should sort of fall off if it's ripe, so you shouldn't have to pull too hard. Can I try that, Monica? I see one that I want to get. It's my name
on
it.
It's a really good device, eh?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's almost like a lacrosse stick, right? It has that sort of, you want to mm-hmm. like... Okay, so the apples aren't supposed to touch the ground.
Because of E. coli?
The trees are definitely way huger than they would normally be if they were, mm-hmm. they were in production, I guess. They're being used. That's okay. More of a challenge. Brahman found a banana tree! A banana tree!
Banana.
Yeah!
Judy, does that have a name, that tool?
Fruit picker.
A fruit picker.
So
a fruit
is what we've been calling them.
Oh, okay.
My name is Julie, and I am involved in a fruit picking project that started a month ago. We've been picking fruit trees that would otherwise not be picked for various reasons. People aren't able to pick their trees, or they don't have the equipment or the time. So they call us, and we come and we pick their trees, and we share the fruit. They can take some, we give some to our volunteers, and then the rest is shared with the community, food banks or other agencies, community kitchens.
Okay, how did this idea start up, or is it something that's been around for a while?
I heard about it. A project that is operating in Victoria called the Victoria Fruit Tree Project. I'm not exactly sure how long they've been doing it, but a number of years. Yeah, we caught wind of it and contacted them. The coordinator sent me a manual on how to start a fruit tree project, and it was pretty intuitive, but it was really helpful. Someone who had been through it. And
so how much, I imagine you've picked a lot of fruit this fall, right?
Yeah,
what kind of fruits have you picked?
We've only been picking for 3 weeks. It took a little while to get everything together, but we've picked close to 1,000 pounds of fruit. Almost all of that has been pears. We've started apples now. We've also picked plums and some peaches, and people are now phoning to say they have grapes. So,
do you want to also talk about just the Eat Local project as well?
Sure, okay. Yeah. Well, initially we had a small grant through Environment Hamilton to start our Eat Local project. And the main idea was to research and put together a directory, an Eat Local directory, so that people in the city could access local sources of food with greater ease. So we've done that now, and it's on our website. And it lists farmers markets, pick your own farms, community gardens, some restaurants that have local food, basically different ways that you can find local food in Hamilton.
So why should people think about eating locally?
Yeah, there are lots of reasons. I think quite a bit about the environmental impacts of, you know, trucking our food around the world to bring it to our tables, that the depletion of fossil fuels and the amount that we're consuming just to bring our food to us, that's a big impact on the environment. So in addition to that, protecting local food lands, if we're not using the farms, the farmland here, that land is going to be developed and houses are going to be built on our farms. And that's what it's happening right now with the Aerotropolis development and what have you. So yeah, protecting local agriculture so that if we aren't able to be importing our food as we always have been, we'll have land that we can grow food on to feed our community. Those are some important reasons, I think, to support local agriculture. What else? It's good for the local economy. You know, you're supporting your neighbors and their businesses. That's another thing, right? You're eating much fresher food. There aren't all the preservatives and additives that are needed to keep the food fresh when you're, you know, trucking it.
Well, the farmer John and the farmer Jane, with the help of the sun and the falling rain, they're growing it right, naturally. Using the ways both the tried and true, like Grandma, Grandpa used to do, growing our food naturally. Well, it looks so good and it tastes good too. How do they do what they do, do, do? They're growing it right, naturally. They grow the happiest apples and the beaniest beans, the yellowest yellows and the greeniest greens, the yummiest yams that you ever did see, and the corniest corn. In the compost pile, nature turns it all worthwhile, making good soil naturally. Now see that soil with a good manure, it's a living and it's so darn pure, feeding the earth naturally. Oh, the good bugs chase the pests away, in the deep of night, in the light of day, guarding our food naturally. We've got the tastiest, juiciest, scrumptiest, the yummiest, oh so good, from your mouth to your tummiest, fruitiest fruit that you ever did see, and the corniest corn,
and the cranniest cram,
berries that is,
oh very funny.
Now the farmer John and the farmer Jane, with the help of the sun and the falling rain, they're growing it right, naturally. Now they're using the ways both the tried and true, like Grandma, Grandpa used to do, growing our food naturally. They're doing it right, naturally. They're growing our food naturally. Oh, the bitiest bites, yummiest yums, grubbiest grub, pioneers piony, bassiest bass, silliest song, corniest corn,
and the cranniest cram,
berries that is.
The end.
I'm gonna wrap myself in paper. I'm gonna daub myself with glue. Stick some stamps on the top of my head. I'm gonna mail myself to you.
Contact Radio Free School at grassroots@hwcn.org or mail P.O. Box 19, 1280 Main Street West, Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, L8S1CO.